Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin. We have with us on the phone today a very special guest, Dr. Steve Fuller, Professor of Sociology at the University of Warwick in the United Kingdom. Dr. Fuller, it's wonderful to have you on the show with us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
Dr. Fuller is well known for his books and writings on intelligent design as something of a defender of intelligent design, as well as having participated in the Kitzmiller versus Dover case as an expert witness, arguing to the court that intelligent design should be considered a form of science. So, Dr. Fuller, I'd like to first just get into a little bit about your background. Can you tell us a little bit about your educational background and what sort of things you have liked to study?
Okay. My PhD is in history and philosophy of science from the University of Pittsburgh, prior to that I received an MPhil from Cambridge University in the same subject, and my undergraduate degree was from Columbia in history and sociology, and I'm primarily known for work in a field I've developed called social epistemology, which is basically about the social foundations of knowledge understood both in empirical and in historical terms, as well as in normative terms. In other words, not just the way in which knowledge is produced and distributed, but also the way it ought to be produced and distributed. So obviously a lot of the attention that I've paid over the years has been to the development of science and the conditions under which something is to be considered a science.
Now, I have many close British relatives, including a British grandmother who emigrated to the U.S. many years ago, and so the British accent sounds very natural to me, but I don't detect much of an accent in your speaking. From looking at your CV, I'm guessing that you're not from the U.K. originally. Is that correct?
No, I'm originally from New York City, and I moved to Britain permanently, I guess, 15 years ago. Though I had been schooled in Britain, I had gone to Cambridge, But it's only been in the last 15 years I've lived regularly in the United Kingdom.
Okay, and it sounds like you've managed to avoid picking too much of an accent up.
Well, I was a bit older, right?
Yeah, that's true. So what first got you interested in the debate over intelligent design? Are you just one of those guys who likes to root for the underdog?
Well, there is something to that, I suppose. I mean, but that's not really the specific reason. I had been following this debate for a while. As someone who's trained in history and philosophy of science, one of the big issues in the field traditionally has been the so-called demarcation problem. How do you tell the difference between science and non-science? And so obviously this issue regarding both evolution and creationism, because both theories at various points in the history and philosophy of science have had question marks over them with regard to their scientific status. In the last 25 years or so, there's been quite a lot of cases about the status of creationism and now intelligent design as science, and in the context of that, in these court cases in the United States, historians and philosophers of science would be brought in as expert witnesses, so by no means was I the first one. I mean, Michael Ruse was a very famous expert witness in the case in Arkansas that took place in 1981. And so there's actually kind of a sort of history where there's a relationship between the history and philosophy of science and these issues about whether to count creationism or evolutionism as science. And so I've always been interested in that.
That's wonderful. And one of the interesting things about you is you've often been very open about your personal ideological or political background and how it doesn't necessarily fit with the common stereotypes of ID sympathizers. Would you mind sharing for us a little bit about where you're personally coming from?
Well, I mean, I'm a person politically from the left, and I don't hide that in any way. And I'm also very much I'm a secular humanist in the sense that I'm a very pro-human person, and I'm also a pro-science person as well. And so, always in the back of my mind is this issue of what is the best course of action for promoting scientific progress, for promoting the welfare of human beings, and so forth. And I do have something of a religious background in that until I went to university, I was trained by the Jesuits. But the kind of training that I received was very much of the sort of liberation theology, kind of social justice agenda that was quite popular in the 1970s within certain more radical arenas in the Catholic Church. But I've never been much of a churchgoer. I don't consider myself a particularly pious person or anything of that kind. But at the same time, I've never been hostile to religion. And I believe that if anyone has a kind of deep understanding of the history of Western culture, one realizes the overriding positive contributions that religion has actually made.
Well, let's turn to the Kitzmiller case. Why did you choose to get involved with that case?
Well, I was invited. it wasn't the defense lawyers. That is to say, the people who were defending the school board who wanted to implement intelligent design as an option for teaching science. They had contacted me, my role there was designed to be a rebuttal witness. That is to say, the plaintiffs had their own array of experts who were basically arguing that. Science is inherently committed to a kind of naturalistic approach to understanding reality, and that there's no role for the supernatural. And not only is there no role for it today, there's never really been a role for it. And I was basically asked whether I would be willing to contest those claims that were being made. And I agreed to that once I had read the expert witness reports that the plaintiffs had submitted. So in other words, I didn't get into this sight unseen. I'd actually had seen what the other side had done, and it was on the basis of that I felt, yes, I feel perfectly comfortable rebutting what those people had said. I was not being proposed as an expert on intelligent design itself. And that came across pretty clearly, I think, in the examination and cross-examination of my testimony.
Now, you testified in the court, I remember reading some of your testimony, that ID is not exactly like creationism, and you said that, quote, it is moved in a completely different direction, unquote. What exactly do you tell the court about ID and creationism?
I mean, one of the big problems, I think, with arguing about this in the courtroom in the United States is because of the way in which the separation of church and state is interpreted in a very kind of, kind of conservative way. You can't actually, if you actually start to say that there are religious roots to any kind of scientific view, you've sort of de facto invalidated it, and that came out very clearly in the judge's verdict. But the thing that's interesting about ID from that standpoint is that the way in which ID presents its arguments are pretty much in the currency, I mean pretty exclusively in the currency that we normally use for adjudicating scientific claims. So there's a, you know, appeal to the evidence, whether we're talking about empirical evidence, there's also appeal to probability-based arguments, appeal to logic. And I think one of the ways in which you can see this very clearly is the fact the way in which intelligent design gets contested by scientists and by philosophers is very much the way one would contest a normal scientific theory. Because the intelligent design doesn't make any explicit references to the Bible or anything of that sort, which is typically the way in which creationism used to operate. And so it was very easy to invalidate creationism because essentially the arguments that you were being presented were very explicitly religious arguments. Okay, but in the case of intelligent design, the actual arguments themselves are scientific ones.
What about methodological naturalism? I know that was a very core issue in the judge's ruling. Did you argue that it should be considered a ground rule of science?
No, I'm very much against that. In fact, I think methodological naturalism is, if you want to talk about pseudoscience, this is pseudo-philosophy. Naturalism is a metaphysical position. It is not a methodological position. It has to do with the way you understand the way the world is constituted. And you're basically saying, well, everything that exists in the world are the things that are immediately available to the senses and the things that we kind of run across in the natural course of things, and that science is only about that. So a very basic kind of empirical understanding of the world. But of course, the progress of science is very much dependent on people thinking, as it were, outside that naturalistic box. That is to say, coming up with ideas having to do with hidden causal mechanisms, hidden variables, underlying structures, strange forces. I mean, we see this, throughout the history of physics very clearly, but also in the history of biology as well. So, for example, I don't think it's accidental that the person who first came up with the foundation of modern genetics was a monk, was someone who believed that, as it were, there were hidden forces of nevertheless a kind of intelligible kind that were responsible for the wide variety of plant and animal species that we see in nature. Okay, that's something that actually requires that you think beyond naturalism to some kind of underlying hidden causal mechanism, which nevertheless you can access scientifically. And that's the key point here, okay? And I think what methodological, so-called methodological naturalists want to do is to conflate two things. They want to conflate the idea of testability and that we need experimental procedure and so forth, which is fine, with the idea that that somehow requires that you believe that the world works in a certain way. And I don't think that's really necessary.
So you would say that some of the requirements or that some of the rules within methodological naturalism are superfluous to the scientific method itself.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what I would say.
Okay. You also talked a lot about how intelligent design is sort of a new theory, and you said at one point that, quote, you have to give it some time to develop, and then you can make further judgment about whether it was good, bad, or not, unquote. Or, you know, you said things like intelligent design faces certain prejudices within the scientific community.
Yeah.
Did you think that it was premature for Judge Jones to argue that ID is not science, and why did you basically argue that ID should be considered scientific?
Well, I mean, see, again, it's very hard making the argument. I mean, the judge seemed to take very seriously the idea that there is a scientific consensus, and that in a sense, having a consensus is essential to science. So in other words, the fact that most of the scientific experts believe that evolution is true and ID is false was sufficient in his mind to invalidate ID. And my point, as far as that was concerned, was that, look, it's actually very difficult for alternative viewpoints to get any kind of hearing in science today. Even a view like intelligent design, which in its current form may be new, so like the arguments of, let's say, Dembski and Behe might be new, but nevertheless has a very respectable and long-standing backstory within the history of science. So it's not like you know, intelligent design was invented by the Discovery Institute, okay? I mean, it actually goes back to Newton, and most of the science that was conducted, you know, up until the 20th century had some kind of intelligent design component to it, okay? But at the moment, within the biological sciences in particular, right, in light of the dominance of Darwinism, it's been ruled out. And it seems to me that it's very difficult to get it back in or to make it into a viable competitor for Darwinism unless some special efforts are made. Because how are students going to find out that there are alternative viewpoints if they're not actually explicitly introduced? I mean, this is the problem, I think, that one faces here. And if you don't actually introduce the alternatives in some kind of formal fashion, then it becomes very difficult to see how these alternatives are going to develop.
Well, I certainly won't disagree with you. Discovery Institute certainly did not invent intelligent design. As a matter of fact, the whole Pandas and People textbook that was talked about a lot in the Kitzmiller case, I don't even think Discovery Institute existed yet when that textbook was first written. So you're absolutely correct, and if you use the term intelligent design, we certainly make no copyright claims. So
I was going to ask, yes, since you're a lawyer.
Yeah, you don't even have to ask. We have no right to give permission. You know, and I think that's the way it should be. Things like scientific theories are far bigger than anything that a person should be able to own. I'm sure you would agree with that.
Well, yes, and in fact, let me make a point about that. I mean, one of the things that I try to bring across when I do defend intelligent design, and you know, you're speaking to me now from Texas. I mean, I'm in Texas, and I'm doing some talks. In fact, tonight I'm doing a big talk having to do with the title "Why Is Intelligent Design Worth Fighting For?" Right, And the key thing here is that a theory like intelligent design, as was the case historically with Darwinism, has to show, you know, one of the ways it shows it's scientific is that you don't have to hold a particular ideological view in order to find the theory attractive and useful and so forth scientifically. That people holding all kinds of different ideological views nevertheless can get scientific mileage out of the theory. I mean, because if you look at the early days of Darwinism, for example, there were very specific kinds of people who were very much motivated to promote it. I mean, people from the sort of rising industrial classes, certain racists were motivated. I mean, there was clear motivation, the kind of people we normally associate these days with social Darwinism. But nevertheless, Darwinism has a very wide constituency across many different groups of people, and there's no reason why intelligent design can't be the same way as well.
So, in your view, Dr. Fuller, is the Kitzmiller ruling dangerous to the progress of science? And if so, why would you say that?
Well, I do think it is, in the sense that it reinforces a bogus view that science cannot progress unless there's consensus on fundamentals. Okay, and that seems to me to turn science into an orthodoxy, you know, into a kind of authoritarian structure, as it were, And also, I think what it does is it halts the progress of inquiry, because it's one thing for having, you know, to have a science textbook or have a science curriculum, you know, lay out all the facts and sort of basic knowledge of a given field and so forth. But when it comes to something like the fundamental explanations by which we join together the different phenomena of nature and try to unify it under, you know, a set of laws or causes or something like that, there should be quite a wide scope for disagreement and dissent and alternative viewpoints, because there's a lot riding on that. Because depending on the kinds of explanations that we give to nature, will determine our attitude toward it. Okay, and it does, and you know, as you well know, it makes a big difference in terms of our attitude toward people and animals and whatever, whether one holds an intelligent design viewpoint or a Darwinian viewpoint.
So if you were in charge of how origins should be taught in public schools, how would you say that this issue should be taught?
Well, first of all, I think the issue here is being able to show that from a set of assumptions, whether they're intelligent design or neo-Darwinism, you can, as it were, start from the sort of fundamental principles and be able to show how you're able to make sense at a scientific level of a wide range of phenomena. And I think, for example, with intelligent design and neo-Darwinism, it seems to me, actually organize the world differently. It's not just that they are, as it were, disagreeing on particular points, but they have a completely rather different way of thinking about things. So for example, I take intelligent design theory to have a very kind of, have a view of thinking about animals and life forms very much, as intelligently designed, as artifacts, essentially. Whereas Darwinism doesn't take this artifact view at all. And in fact, Darwin's own writings tend to stress the disanalogies between nature and artifacts. You start off with those very fundamentally different assumptions, and then you say, well, okay, what aspects of nature can be illuminated through those assumptions, and what aspects might not be illuminated by those assumptions, and then sort of lay it out for the students to see. And it seems to me that's the way to do it. Show how the larger principles actually illuminate the phenomena that you're interested in understanding.
It sounds to me like you're far more interested in teaching them how to think than what to think.
Well, I think if we're talking about high school, see, this is this is why I recommend this especially at the high school level. Because at the high school level, in a sense, what you're trying to do, you're not trying to, as it were, train professional scientists. You're trying to get students to think scientifically and hopefully to get them to want to, you know, think scientifically in a general way as they go through life and so forth. And so you have to actually show what that means, right, as a practice.
That sounds exactly right to me. Well, Dr. Fuller, this has been very, very fun and interesting and educational to talk to you, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being on the show with us.
No problem.
This is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast. Stay tuned for more interviews with Dr. Steve Fuller. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.